Welcome to the CyberQ podcast. This episode is part of our Cyber Vision series, where we explore the future of cyber insurance through expert insight, innovation, and thought leadership. I'm your host, Rihanna Mistry, content specialist at CyberCube, and today we'll be discussing the cyber retro market. With me is Rebecca Boll, CyberCube's head of strategic engagement, and Suki Shahid, Guy Carpenter's managing director of international cyber analytics. Thank you both for joining me. I'm excited to get into this topic. First, could you introduce yourselves, Rebecca?
Yeah, I'm Rebecca Boll. I'm head of strategic engagement at CyberCube. And in my role, I spend time with kind of a wide range of market participants, including insurance regulators and supervisors, government entities, and the capital markets, all with a view to kind of helping bring everyone together to build a robust long-term cyber risk transfer market that ultimately improves the resilience of organizations and society. So happy to be here.
I'm Suki Shahid. I'm heading the cyber analytics for UK international markets at Guy Carpenter. So for whoever does not know, Guy Carpenter is a reinsurance broker. So that means that my role is really to enable carriers, reinsurers, whoever wants to play in this industry and specifically on cyber, to help them understand the risk, help them make the decisions for risk transfer mechanism, but both at the carrier side and the reinsurance side.
Before we get into the topic, Suki, do you mind explaining what the cyber retro market is?
Absolutely. This is one of my favorite topic recently. So this is the best way maybe, or the simplest way to capture it is retrocession is reinsurance or insurance on it, like reinsurance, if you want. So there are a couple of things to bear in mind is the players are reinsurers and their cedents are also reinsurers. So this is also like a risk transfer mechanism supporting reinsurers to transfer and mitigate their risk. And excited to be here today to talk about it.
So why is now the time for the industry to be thinking about it?
Well, I think when we look at it overall, just as an industry, and I would be interested in Rebecca's like perspective as well, is the cyber industry has grown massively over the past couple of years, right? Like if we look at our estimates at Guy Carpenter, we are estimating for 2024, it is a $16.6 billion gross written premium on the cyber insurance market. We are no longer talking about the $2 to $3 billion that were there for a while. Like we're talking now about a bigger piece of the market. And that means that people and carriers and reinsurers have grown on this line of business. And that means that reinsurers are even more interested today, more than before, in finding ways and avenues to help them mitigate their risk, right? So this is why we would like to talk about it. But I think it's really also important to remind the audience the benefit of, like a retrocession, like why are we talking about it? So as I mentioned, and I think that's going to be a key term today, it's the risk transfer. Like retrocession is a risk transfer tool. So reinsurers will be able to also transfer a part of their risk to another reinsurer, which will in turn enable growth in the whole chain. Because if the primary reinsurer is ceding a chunk of the risk, that means they can take on more potentially as they grow. And that means that the ultimate carrier who is having a reinsurance in place with that primary reinsurer can also grow. And that is like really supporting that economy and boosting that growth as we are all seeking and thriving for.
Yeah, I agree. I think in my mind, retro is a crucial link in the chain, a sort of demonstration of a robust, well-functioning risk transfer market. It's kind of that release valve, if you like, for, there's exposures are growing. Those exposures obviously have accumulations within reinsurers and having that kind of release valve for reinsurers to transfer some of that off of their balance sheets is a good sign for the market, I'd say. It's also a source of income for, capital providers who wouldn't necessarily get exposure to cyber and to get some of those premiums, be those traditional reinsurers or alternative capital. And I think in my mind, there's a delicately balanced cocktail, if you like, of ingredients that had to come together to create that thriving retro market. I think one, as you point out, is the size of the market needs to be big enough to warrant enough reinsurance being purchased, and then that risk management mechanism for those reinsurers to transfer that further on. So it's like purely the size of the market, and that's growing healthily. I think also another element to build that is basically comes down to sort of confidence and discipline in the market. So an understanding of where those exposures are accumulating, sort of what that tail risk could be, and a common understanding of that tail helps to enable that further transaction. And I think thirdly, just a stability in the market. So an understanding of where the terms and conditions are, that there is pricing discipline, that there is an understanding of the exclusionary terms and conditions, and that they are robust. I think all of that sort of again helps to create a foundation that allows that retro market to grow. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
No, absolutely. I totally agree. I think the maybe other things to add to this is it was like fascinating to me in the conversation that I had lately with reinsurers who do not necessarily write cyber. And they were like, actually, if we start writing the retro, this is our door opener to write cyber with other reinsurers that we trust and we know have like a good grasp of the risk. And that is, you know, like setting a foot at the door in order to say, can we start understanding this line of business? But it also does not mean that they have to, you know, like write cyber on the direct side. They can still just be like a retro partner. But it was just to really promote that capital and be able to have a share of the pie of a line of business that I would like to remind the audience is quite profitable. So this is quite key. So, but to your point, exactly, like tail risk is, you know, like the key, I'm going to say metric or type of risk that retrocede and try to mitigate. Also, like if they try to enable that capital, you know, like need and put a relief on it. So by retaining it all in their balance sheet, it can be like a bit of a struggle, and they will have like key metrics to manage as well. And in those conversations that I had lately, it was interesting to see how they have grown even in that retro market, like the retrocedents, where we were talking maybe just 3 years back, the smallest one will have less than 100K revenue, you know, like from a cyber reinsurance perspective. And those have grown to 300K to half a million to more. So those are really in need of those retro solutions to help them exactly to what you said, right?
When we do talk about the tail in cyber, what kinds of events are we trying to capture for or prepare for? And how does modelling play a part in that?
I'm happy to start about what the tail entails. Ooh, no pun intended, but so the tail for us is still those peak scenarios that we are still in cyber. We have not seen them happening or materialising yet. But those are the peak scenarios that we feel are still extreme and plausible that could occur. So even if we have not seen any experience to date, even if we heard about the CrowdStrike or, you know, like the PowerSchool, and we look at the recent outages or the Mark and Spencer or the UK retail events, those are not yet tail risks that are just showing you what might happen in a realm of cyber eventualities. But tail risk would be anything really extreme, severe enough, affecting either several companies or maybe like a little bit less than several companies, but still being materially significant and plausible that can occur. So that's how we would see tail risk. So we think maybe it's going to be a global outage potentially. It can be a third party supplier or supply chain attack affecting multiple segments as opposed to just a mono sector, as we have seen historically. It can be like a wipe away type of thing. So those would be qualifying for tail risk events that the market is really like assessing or trying to mitigate their exposure to. But we'd be interested in your thoughts as well from a, you know, CyberKeep perspective.
Yeah. And I concur. I mean, retro thrives in those peak peril markets. So in natural catastrophe, pick a number, but, you know, it's around $60 billion kind of dollars or so that is transferred into the retro markets in Nat Cat. And that's kind of those peak perils where there really is an extreme event where it's enough to stress those reinsurers' balance sheets potentially should that loss occur and they need that additional hedge. So you sort of look at that peak peril aspect. What are those peak perils in cyber? That you mentioned some of them there. And, you know, from CyberCube's kind of point of view, really where we see that sort of extreme tail is in cloud, both service and infrastructure events, mainly as outages, in widespread malware and ransomware being really a feature of those types of events. And then a sort of mass data breach event that, as you rightly said, would not just affect one company or even particularly one industry, but would have that broader reach. In terms of what would that event look like today? I mean, just taking the US market, and let's call that sort of $10 billion today, you know, we sort of look at that $10 billion market and say that that extreme event, that one in 250-year event, is somewhere in the region of a kind of $21 billion loss, maybe a little more than that. But, you know, as you layer on the growth of the market there, I mean, we did some projections out 10 years and that premium is fivefold. And that one in 250-year event at that point, $121 billion. So it's another $100 billion of capital required. And this is just for the US market to sort of meet those extreme losses. And so where does that $100 billion come from is, I think, an interesting question for us to dig into.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the second part of the question, Rihanna, that you ask is how do models tackle, you know, like tell, you know, like events? And I think there is a consensus. It's rare to see a consensus now around the three leading vendor models, but there is a consensus in the industry and amongst the vendor models around the type of events. And this is exactly what you mentioned, Rebecca, and the things that I mentioned earlier around the cloud and the ransomware malware type of events are the ones that we think are in the tail. But the way they materialize is what is drastically different. And I think we are still on the hunt around how can those events actually materialize? So this is where, you know, it's interesting in the exercise that you mentioned and the quantification of the $100 billion of losses. I'm pretty sure a lot of counterfactual analysis went behind the scenes in order to come up with those estimates. And this is exactly what different vendors do in different degrees and levels of maturity based on either historical precedents or also like just talking to cybersecurity experts. And this is where we are in interesting times, because when we speak to cloud service providers like the hyperscalers, for example, such as the Amazon Web Services of the world or the Google Cloud of the world, and we tell them, would this happen? And they're like, absolutely not. And they were like, so what is this concept of tail risk if you tell us this is really remote? But actually, the fact that they say it's not going to happen makes them the right candidate for that tail risk, because that means it's really, really low probability of occurring. But if it does happen, it is catastrophic. Would it impact, you know, the industry and burn the entire things? Maybe. But is it going to impact every pocket of the industry in the same way? Well, we know that the answer is no, because of how the market is segmented and how everyone is relying differently on those services. But this is exactly the type of information that we are looking for, like through those vendors, to understand what tail risk is and how they approach it.
Yeah. And I think that comes back to sort of one of those ingredients in the cocktail to have a thriving retro market is that coalescence around what is tail risk and that confidence in the modeling. And, you know, that's partly our job. You know, that's what we do. We create those models. And I think, you know, being transparent about how we're doing that, being transparent about kind of the inputs into that modeling, the assumptions, and of course, there have to be assumptions in a model, kind of what those are and why we deem those to be credible, and then sharing that with the market. And I think, you know, we are open with our clients as to how we do what we do, but then it's about validate. It's kind of look at each event that comes in and look at the impact that event had in the guise that it took at the time. But then to your point also, let's stress that. Let's do some counterfactual. What if certain criteria were slightly different? How might that play out? And I think just always testing the possible and then kind of applying that probability to it kind of helps to bring a little bit more confidence in the marketers to kind of that tail exists and this is what it could look like in the absence of it actually having happened in reality. I think, you know, for the NatCat world, you know, they have the benefit there of having plenty of data points of, you know, those Cat 5 hurricanes actually making landfall, et cetera, and those losses playing through. we don't have that in cyber. So I think that is certainly very important for us at CyberCube to play our role in creating that sort of confidence and stability in what that tail looks like, and that parties can transfer risk kind of based on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think if we put the retrocession lens onto this, right, before we get to that retrocession, just based on the conversation that, you know, everything you said, Rebecca, right, shows how it is a problem, like accumulation or tail risk is a problem for every single member of the chain. So it's the carrier. Are they writing the right product? Are they having the right reinsurance in place to help them cope with that tail risk? It's the reinsurer on the direct side. Am I having the right product in order to promote, you know, like the growth of the carrier and therefore my growth as a reinsurer? But also, am I able to retain all that risk? So that retro, that tail risk become more of a problem, because as you go further in the chain, that's what matters the most, as you like said so. And that's why, like, the difficulty, I'm going to say, or challenges that we are currently observing in the retro market is, what type of product should I give in order to help relieve the pressure on that reinsurer or retroceded in that case? But equally, I am not just taking the heat as a retrocession market. So that's why, if it is, for example, a quota share or any proportional treaty that exists, that is just a swap almost of risk. It's just like a money swap of hands, and this is usually not the right, you know, like product that the retrocession markets would like to do on a quota share. Like, they would never, or I'm not gonna say never, we never say never in this industry, which is like great, but they would unlikely pick a quota share to protect a quota share, because this is just a money swap. But that's why we need to be even more clever in really identifying those points that you really eloquently said, Rebecca. So in order to define what type of structures or product pertain to the retrocession market to enable everyone to mitigate the risk, optimize their capital and grow without taking the heat of that tail risk.
So I'd love to dig in a little bit more on some of those structures and the capital that is behind those structures. So we've seen catastrophe bonds, for example, being issued by some of the major reinsurers, and some of those are on an industry loss trigger basis. Some are on aggregate basis. Yeah, I'm sure there are also other instruments being used. Obviously, the catastrophe bonds are public and therefore most discoverable. But I wonder if you can maybe just elaborate a little bit on what are some of those instruments and who's providing the capital? Is this capital markets? Is it traditional reinsurers providing that role?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd like to split it into two, right? So you have the traditional market, and then you have the alternative capital, right? Also known as the insurance linked securities, so the ILS for short. So under the traditional market, this is where every structure that we know of today in the direct reinsurance are still applicable. So we are still talking about quota share. We are still talking about aggregate stop loss, just because it helps alleviate and remove the, I'm going to say, the uncertainty around some of the parameters. Let me be clearer. So think about, if we try to just set an event cover on a retro, then you need to define what an event means. And that event, if you are a retrocedent, you want the wording to be mirroring what you are writing in order to have a back-to-back cover. But what if the two reinsurers do not agree on those terms because they have two different views? What if there are some exclusions that do not do that? So we still see a little bit of battle around this, because as I said earlier, retrocession, you know, reinsurer do not necessarily play on the cyber space. So those conversations become even more important and even more challenging for them, because you're not necessarily talking to cyber experts. They are dipping their toes in this space. Conversations are a little bit easier with other reinsurers who understand that, but it's still, they try to avoid, you know, like difficult or complex mechanism that give them some peace of mind as well. So that's why what we are still seeing common in the industry on the traditional reinsurance market is the quota shares and the aggregate stop loss. But then comes the alternative capital. This is something that we are exploring, but I think here volume is still not appealing too much for investors from the retro perspective. They feel like on a direct side, they will have more return on their investment compared to the retro. And on the retro, they feel like that the uncertainty is too high around that risk, that there is still a lot of education that needs to happen. You're absolutely right. We saw the emergence of the cat bonds, you know, the public ones, and we have seen ILWs on the direct side. I think there is one ILW on a retro, and then there is one parametric solution just on the cloud on the retro. So the lessons learned is on the ILW on the retro is it's still quite chunky. You need to have a massive industry loss net of all reinsurance before you can trigger that ILW. So that's why there is still like perception that there is a mismatch between that threshold and potentially the price that comes with it. But at least on a capital perspective, and depending on the models that are used and the metrics that are mitigated, that ILW allows them to really understand what capital optimization they can do and transfer at least the real true tail risk. Then on the second solution that we saw, that parametric on the cloud, I think the lessons learned is they wanted to set precedent and have a parametric solution, but it's really limited to cloud. They would love to do the same for all other perils. So how can we as an industry help them, you know, like not just that particular reinsurer, but the market in general? How can we help the reinsurers in that market really get comfortable and move to those parametric and alternative solutions? So I think this is where there is still that education piece quite important, because as soon as we go to alternative markets, we are tapping into traditional reinsurers who play in that space, but we also tap into investors. And I think today we still do not see dedicated funds for cyber. It's either leftovers from property funds or small pots for cyber from specific investors, right? I'm not going to be mentioning any name today, but like I think some of them are really known. They are really vocal on cyber and they would like to do more, but they are also vocal on what are the terms and conditions that happen. So really to unlock that potential, I think there is so much room on both the traditional and the alternative capital. Alternative capital that is going to become an easier conversation organically as the market matures and as the premium grows for both direct and the retro. And because today, out of the 16.6 billion that I quoted on the direct side, we estimate the ceded premium to be between that 5 to 6.6 billion premium. So that's the volume. So nothing to do with the 60 billion that we see, for example, on the property, but we are getting there. We have to start somewhere. So that's why we are seeing a massive appetite more on the traditional side, because they understand that issue. They also want to get the protection, and the reinsurers, like who will be the retro partners, are also like keen on, you know, finding a solution for that market to support that growth overall.
So we've discussed where the reinsurance market needs to be to have the hunger for the retro market. Rebecca, I'd love to hear your perspective on what role the public sector might need to play if the tail risk proves too extreme or systemic.
So, yes, I believe there are circumstances where an extreme cyber event may be beyond the capabilities or the willingness of the private market to respond fully. So I think that that eventuality exists and is being explored in various jurisdictions to various extents as to kind of where those gaps are. Where might the private market reach its limits in terms of its willingness or ability to cover some of the extreme events? Whereas I think, as we mentioned at the beginning, retrocessions are a really crucial link in the chain of a high-functioning risk transfer market and is a great sign of that robustness of the market. And I think we want to see that market grow and absorb as much risk as it can. And I'm sure it has the ability, the insurance sector globally, to absorb much more risk than it does today. So I want to make sure that there is that runway there and that the private market can go as far as it can go. But there are certain risks, certain events that are deemed uninsurable. And in that event, losses, financial losses will still be incurred. You know, citizens of a country will still be impacted, but it's not the role of the insurance sector to make them good for those losses. So in that event as well, having a government backstop to cover those losses that wouldn't be reimbursed, or where the losses are so extreme that they exceed is, I think, just prudent preparation for a government to protect its citizens and structured correctly, not be a threat to the development of the private market as well.
No, absolutely. I think it's interesting to see how the role of the government or public sector in general evolves as we matured as an industry, and not just on cyber, but in general. So when we discuss with regulators, you know, the cyber risk, the common theme is how can we help those insurers get comfortable with risk they do not write today? Touching on the point that you made around the uninsurable part, they really try to understand what makes them uninsurable. Can they do anything to alleviate that pressure in order to enable some carriers to write it? And actually, what is uninsurable in the US versus what is uninsurable in the UK and in Europe varies greatly. Like in Europe, for example, infrastructure is not necessarily excluded, whereas it is in the UK and US market. So the role of the government or regulator or public sector in general on that aspect will vary as well. But there is that mindset. Can we help carriers do a better job? Can we help reinsurers do a better job? So backstop becomes the last resort. They also like explore avenues like having pools in place. Is there something that we can make it mandatory so everyone has to pitch in, so it's fair on the entire industry and everyone has a foot in on this line of business? So there are a lot of initiatives that really support that, and it's pleasing to see that it's not like, oh, let's dictate or let's mandate, or you're unable to do this, so we're going to start with the backstop because you're unable to do it, and then we will force you to write something you don't have an appetite. So there is that common understanding and open dialogue between public sector and regulators in particular and the players in the space at different levels. And I think we would like to encourage more of it. Just again, recently, we were talking with the Treasury in the US. We were talking with regulators in Asia, in Europe. And they are posing really sophisticated questions compared to just 5 years ago. Like today, for example, they are asking me, what is the correlation between sectors and between events? And I'm like, well, it's hard to answer that question because we do not know everything. Like if we just take the non-cyber attack, like the Portugal and the Spain power outage, like that blackout, it impacted North Africa in a completely different manner. The Wi-Fi was down. Whereas in Portugal and Spain, it was a blackout. And I'm like, there are correlations that a specific vulnerability and technology has a different impact elsewhere because of the way it's utilized, but we do not have that visibility. As cybersecurity, they were like gobsmacked when they understood that it's a power, it's a utility firm, and it impacted the Wi-Fi in North Africa. They were like, how? We don't understand. So it's really hard questions to answer, but I feel like they are right to ask those questions just to keep us on our toes, because at the end of the day, uncertainty is, I think, a key word in our line of business. And we want to give and provide comfort around that uncertainty on cyber risk. So how can we do it is like by exploring all these avenues and come up with justification as to why we're unable to approach it, or maybe find out new ways to approach those topics. So that's really good to see from regulatory bodies.
Yes. And I think, you know, on that insurance supervisory, insurance regulatory point, Suki, it is great to see and really encouraging to have those conversations today with those insurance supervisory organizations, where the level of understanding and the degree of education that they are looking to develop on cyber risk is way beyond where it was just a few years ago. I think that engagement is really encouraging. And I think ultimately insurance supervisors are there to protect the policyholder. And so the lens that they sort of put onto how insurers are going about their business and from their point of view to protect those policyholders, it's just another layer of that confidence and sign of maturity of the market, that we've reached an understanding of cyber risk. We're transferring enough cyber risk for us now to really be thinking deeply about how we're doing that and putting that regulatory framework in place, which I think just is a real sign of maturity and badge of credibility in the market.
Absolutely. And just to link it to my favorite topic today of retro, by having the regulator as that supervisory power or role means that they will put a solution in place if they deem it right, and they will in turn require a protection to help them put that solution in place. So as you can see, there are so many avenues where that retrocession is key and needed, and that's why understanding where those avenues can come from is important for those players.
As you've said today, Suki, retro is super topical at the moment, and it's really important that the reinsurance market understands it. But what can they do next to make it a reality? What steps should the market be taking?
So just to make it a reality, I think really like speak to your partners. So whether reinsurance brokers, vendors, even if they're not partners, I think everyone in this industry, particularly in cyber, are open for that dialogue and that conversation. So we can like give them and empower them and arm them with the tools they need and the insights they need to get comfortable. Like as we said at the beginning with Rebecca, this is a profitable line of business. We should remind them of that. So even if we're talking about terror risk, yes, we have to talk about the gloomy days, but it doesn't mean that it's gloomy every day. And it doesn't mean that actually the profitability is shying away. We are still seeing healthy margins. So to make it a reality is, if you have a dedicated cyber team and you have the tools in place in order to become a retro player, or you are retrocedent who are interested in a solution, now is the time to benefit from the better terms that you can get in the market and to have the right partners that will be long-term relationships.
Thank you for listening to the CyberQ podcast, where we break down cyber risk, insurance, and everything in between. If you enjoyed today's conversation, make sure to subscribe on your preferred listening platform and tune in for the next episode. And don't forget to check out www.cybercube.com or find us on LinkedIn or X for extra content and updates. Until next time, stay informed, stay resilient, and keep shaping the future of cyber insurance.